Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Mental health and substance disorders, probably topics that many don't know a whole lot about unless they've experienced them. One of the reasons for a lack of knowledge is there's a stigma attached to both that can keep people from asking for or seeking help. Our guests today say mental health and substance disorders can be prevented before they dominate someone's life. Joining us is Sharon Engdahl, Executive Director of the American Mental Wellness Association and the Mental Wellness Awareness Association. Ms. Engdahl, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us is Michael Hauser, Vice President of School Youth Programs with RC21X and My Brain 365. Mr. Hauser, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, thank you very much for allowing me to be here this morning.
And we will identify what RC21X and My Brain 365 is, so stay tuned, you'll find out. One of the reasons that I wanted to do this program is because just what I said in the introduction is that mental health and substance disorders, we know we're hearing so much about substance disorders today with the opioid crisis, but it's one of those things that society just doesn't talk about, that there is this stigma attached to these things that for the most part, we don't acknowledge them. I say we, and that's not a universal statement, but we don't as much as we would do some other illnesses. Why?
That's a good question. It should stop. There should not be any stigma anymore, and people should be encouraged to talk about mental health issues, and that includes substance use disorders. And so I think what's happening now is people are opening up, but not as quickly as it should be. In fact, I've researched the subject for over 40 years, and I've known for over 40 years that prevention and early intervention work, and the message hasn't gotten out, and I have researchers that have backed that up. So we're here as the American Mental Wellness Association and the Mental Wellness Awareness Association of Pennsylvania to stop that silence and to get the word out that prevention and early intervention works. And in fact, mental health problems precede a substance use disorder by about 3 years. So if you really want to win on the opiate epidemic crisis and other addiction issues, we need to address prevention and early intervention of mental health problems now.
I want to deal with a couple issues right up front. You touched on this, Sharon, but when we spoke yesterday, you were quick to point out to me when I said mental health disorders, you were quick to mention substance disorders as well. Why?
Well, because more people are talking about substance use disorders than getting to the core of the problem to end addictions, and that is to deal with the education of prevention and early intervention of mental health problems so that they know the early signs and symptoms so they go to their family doctor and get help and don't get into the third and fourth stages of the illness where they're self-medicating on substances that are not good for them, or they have suicidal ideation, or they die. So just like every medical condition, these are medical conditions, and they have stages of the medical condition from first to fourth, and we need to show people through education what those early stages are so they go to their family doctor and get well. Neuroscience has proven this, and we're behind the times of getting that message to the grassroots and having the information available for them, just like we have for cancer and other medical conditions.
Are you saying that everyone who abuses a substance has some form of mental health disorder?
Well, the statistics are saying that, as a researcher, 85%. So that's so important to know, and that message hasn't gotten out until now. And that's what we're doing. And we have our truth statement on the American Mental Wellness website that basically backs everything up with research that we need to get mental health problems taken care of early so that we solve the problem of addiction too.
You know, and when I said I wanted to deal with several issues right up front, one is language that we use. So far, we have not used the words mental illness.
That's right.
And again, when we spoke yesterday, you stopped me when I said that mental illness. Why not?
We do not want people to get to the stage where they have a severe mental illness. These are treatable at the early stages, and so we call them a mental health problem. And the research has shown that everyone, nearly everyone, is going to have a mental health problem in their life sometime. Well, if that's the case, and it is, why aren't we telling people what to look for as far as early signs and symptoms and what they can do to work to prevent it?
See, I think what happens is many people, when they think of mental health problems or mental illness, they right away go to the serious mental illness, the schizophrenias, the, bipolar disorders. But we know that there are many others out there. I mean, the statistics that I saw is that nearly one in five people, children, young people, and adults, sometime during their lifetime will have, suffer from mental health problems. So what are we talking about? What illnesses, what mental health problems are we talking about?
Well, Scott, that's a good question. And science is starting to discover that anxiety, it may be a precursor to all of the illnesses. General anxiety is a huge problem, and it's one of the highest number of people in the world that have that mental health condition. And so does general anxiety precede depression? That's being asked right now by the researchers, okay? So our major medical conditions that we would like to address is anxiety and depression. And, you mentioned bipolar. People don't know that bipolar is one of the most treatable mental health issues in the country. But it's hard to diagnose. So if they learn the early signs and symptoms and they can get an earlier diagnosis, the less severe the problem is, and the less they lose out on their lifetime optimal living.
Mm-hmm. What were you going to say?
Just to piggyback on what Sharon has been saying about the incidence of stress in the lives of people. Part of my background includes being a high school principal in suburban Pittsburgh for 17 years.
That may be a little stressful.
Yeah, just a little bit stressful. But I don't want to talk about the stress of being a high school principal. I really want to talk about the stress of being a student in this modern society. And when we hear about things like what happened in Parkland, what happened in Maryland just the other day, knowing that the modern lives of students are filled with extreme amounts of stress. You know, there's the stress of needing to fit into school society. There's the stress and pressure of achieving academically. There's the stress and pressure of being the star athlete. Just the stress and pressure of being accepted and not being bullied in your school. And when these things happen in the lives of okay, we're talking about young people. Just think about what happens when that stress gets built up and there's no way for a kid to know how to relieve that. And if that becomes a part and parcel of their life, they're really subject to being mentally not well. I know we use the term mentally ill, but think of just being not mentally well and not really having the means, the people in your lives who can help guide you to a better way of dealing with those stresses and anxieties.
And by the way, if you'd like to jump into our conversation, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a message or a question on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I want to step back for just a moment. Yes, anxiety, but that is so widespread. I mean, I was anxious this morning because I have so many things going on. But does that mean that I am suffering from a mental health disorder at this time, or does it have to ratchet up to another level?
Well, that's a good question. And the answer is, if you have anxiety because you have a pertinent, very, substantive reason for it, that's normal and that's healthy, okay? But if it does impair your ability to make good decisions, to participate in normal activities, then you have a problem. And I have a problem with some of the information that's been put out that it says, if you feel like this for 2 weeks, go to a doctor. Well, in 2 weeks, you can get very, very sick. You can get very sick to the point where you might have a suicide ideation, or you may even act on that, and unfortunately, you may die from it. So our information that we're trying to get out, it's on our website under resources. We have 4 different levels of cards for ages, and we have kindergarten and preschool. One side's prevention, one side's early intervention. We have middle school. One side's prevention, one side's early intervention. And the same for high school and adults and my age group, older adults. So get the information, know what to look for, know what to do to prevent it, just like you know about cancer issues now. And then if you do get sick, go to your doctor immediately and you won't get so sick that we have to call it a huge mental illness.
You're using terminology that many people probably don't use. You compared it to cancer. You said being sick. Many people, and you hear this very often, people say, is it a mental illness or a physical illness? That language is very important to you.
Yes, it is. And I do presentations across the state that I actually have a PowerPoint slide where I ask everybody in the audience to read this, that says they'll never separate the mind from the body again. The mind's connected to the body to the mind, i.e. that's the central nervous system. And I will never ever again call it physical health or mental health. Mental health problems are physical health problems, and that is where we need to be. And semantics is important. Don't use that anymore. Don't separate the mind and the body. They're physical illnesses. Neuroscience has proven that over the past 20 years. And we need to get the grassroots to realize that I need to know the early signs and symptoms from myself, my children, my loved ones, and get help promptly. And since there's a lack of psychiatrists and psychologists and even family physicians in Pennsylvania, we encourage you to go to your family physician because your access to care there is much quicker. And then if the problem does get worse, then you need to go to a specialist. The physician is already treating you as a family doctor, and the transition is graceful.
We're going to talk more about prevention in just a moment. We had a comment here from a listener who says, when are we going to stop blaming victims? Others may be causing part of the problems as well. And I hope that's not what it sounds like we're doing in this conversation. This just may be a general comment. But do we as a society do that? Do we blame victims for their mental health or their substance abuse disorders?
Well, look at the incarceration rate. Dauphin County cares so much. They're a wonderful county. Our leaders, the commissioners, are working really hard to try to reduce the number of people with mental health problems in their county jails. But yes, we are blaming victims. When you have a mental health problem, your decision-making is not what it should be. And sometimes you break the law. And so what I have learned over my 40 years of researching this issue and analyzing it is the only way we win is prevention and early intervention education of mental health problems, which includes substance use disorders, and using tools like My Brain 365 that helps you see what your brain health is and if it's slipping or if you can improve it.
We're going to talk about that in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. We're talking about mental health disorders, substance abuse disorders today with Sharon Engdahl, Executive Director of the American Mental Wellness Association, Michael Hauser, Vice President of School Youth Programs with RC21X, and My Brain 365. We'll explain what those two things are in just a moment. If you have a question or comment about mental health, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You could leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. To learn more about the mental health issues, plus a deeper look at the changing tide of healthcare, check out WITF's Transforming Health. From policy to personal choices, we're taking a comprehensive look at today's health system. Online at transforminghealth.org, a partnership of WITF, Penn State Health, and WellSpan Health. I want to talk a little bit more about prevention before we go into the apps. You have talked often, just here in the 20 minutes we've been speaking, Sharon, about prevention. This often is not what many people in our society think of first. They think that, there's a brain disorder, there's a chemical imbalance, that there are many reasons for someone to be going through a mental health disorder, a mental health issue, but there's nothing we can do to prevent it. You don't agree with that. What are you talking about preventing, and how do you prevent this?
Well, our health is important, and we learn about heart health. We learn about preventing cancer. It all is relevant to preventing a brain disorder, a brain disease, a central nervous problem that is, connected through the neuroscience of the brain and the central nervous system. So get plenty of sleep, maintain a healthy diet, stay physically active. And we have all those things that you can do for prevention on our website. However, you can get sick. In fact, the research is showing that it's almost as prevalent as the flu across, cohorts of people. And so let's work to stay brain well, have brain health. And I just wanted to share with your listeners that the Institute of Medicine and National Research has said that a $1 investment in early treatment and prevention programs of mental health problems yields $2 to $10 worth of savings in health costs, criminal and juvenile justice costs, educational costs, and lost productivity. Now, I always look for the best public policy. I am stressing to your listeners that we all need to get our elected officials to provide for prevention and early intervention education so that we can have healthier people in our lives, in our communities, in our homes, and save those limited dollars.
The difference, though, with heart disease or maybe even cancer or some other illnesses is that many people can live that kind of lifestyle that you just described, but still they may fall into depression.
Correct.
They may, just as was described earlier, be a student that does not feel like they fit in. That I guess the point I'm making is that even if you live that kind of lifestyle, there's no guarantee. Well, of course, there's no guarantee for anything. But does it really help you to be more mentally healthy?
Well, the answer to that is yes. However, genetics play a huge role.
Right. That's a risk factor.
That's
yeah.
right. And environment plays a huge role. Okay.
If I have a death in a family.
Right. Trauma. Especially if we don't address trauma when it happens, then it's going to show up later in life. And I'm so glad we're getting to that point, that this message is getting out, because it's been something that should have been addressed years ago. And so now we are doing that many times in our schools.
Michael Hauser, Vice President of School Youth Programs for RC21X and My Brain 365. I know that we have listeners who are asking, okay, what is RC21X and My Brain 365?
That's the question that we get all the time coming to the company and for the folks who work with us. Let me preface what I'm going to say by saying this. When your brain is not performing like it is normally supposed to, everything in life is harder. Mm-hmm. Everything, being able to do things physically, being able to do things mentally, doing your job to the best that you should be doing your job, no matter what your occupation is, being that athlete, being that student, being that good husband or wife. So if your brain is not performing like it is normally supposed to, again, everything in life is harder. And so what our app is, a way to measure how your brain is performing using a smartphone or a tablet that is web connected. Get a baseline, what we call profile, of how your brain is performing. And as you continue to use the app, and again, it only takes 6 minutes to get a measurement anytime during the day, during the week, during the month. So this is something that you can repeat on a regular basis. It's actually engaging. We sometimes say it's fun, but what you can do now that you could not do before is really get a quick and reliable picture about how your brain is performing.
Well, what kind of questions does it ask, or how does it do that?
Well, it's based upon games. Couple of neuroscientists out of the University of Texas at Arlington, actually over 50 years of research and clinical applications using pencil and paper tests and also tabletop apparatus. What they did, they actually took what they've worked on for over 50 years and basically digitized it and put it into this app that we have. So it's actually playing a series of games, but from that series of games, you get to see how your brain is performing. And again, one game session compared to the next will give you a good, as I said, reliable picture of how your brain is doing. And if there are some deficiencies in the completion of any of these games, what it does, it raises a red flag, just the same as if you take your temperature and instead of the 98.6, now you're reading 103. What do you do when you have that 103 on your thermometer? You think about, well, why am I having these high temperatures? And if it's persistent, you're going to consult your medical practitioner. So the same thing is true with our app. You know, the app raises a red flag that your brain is not performing in one or more areas like it normally should. And so if you see that this is a downward trend in your self-assessment, and that's the beauty of this, you don't need to go to a doctor. You don't need to go to a clinician. You can do this in the comfort of your own home, pretty much any time of the day. You can even do it at work if you want to, if you're so inclined, or if there is a need to do that. But what the app allows you to do, it allows you to do that real-time assessment, and if there is an indication that your brain is not performing, again, like it normally is supposed to for you, it raises a red flag and gives you an opportunity to question, what did I do or what happened in my life that is causing my brain to perform in a manner that's less than it normally does.
What that kind of reminds me of is a test for concussion symptoms, or also Alzheimer's disease, dementia, is that tests like that are given to those who may have some symptoms of dementia. Let's take some phone calls. Ken is in Carlisle. Ken, you're on the air.
Thank you. I want to say that I'm a mental health professional with 45 years of experience as a clinical psychologist. I was on hold for a while, so I'm still back with, I believe her name was Sharon, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. I'm bothered by what she's saying. I hear her focusing on individuals without much commentary about socioeconomic background, boys versus girls, race, all those factors. Now, I understand. So my concern is it starts to sound like Big Brother is watching here, which bothers me a lot. Like you're going to start examining every individual kid and they show some behavioral thing and all of a sudden they've got a mental health issue. I will say just one more thing. One of the things I run into, and I mostly deal almost 95% with adults, I only encounter children when they're part of a family. A lot of people, I'll ask them when they come in for counseling, individual counseling, what's your experience of being counseled in the past? And one of the most frequent things I'm told is, boy, did I hate it. I was just a kid, and I'm pushed into this room, and I'm supposed to talk about my problems to somebody. And so there's this immediate sort of prejudice against being in counseling, even though at this point in their life they may be in some serious trouble. So I certainly appreciate early identification in a certain sense, but it almost feels like, I don't know, some large percent of the population of young people are going to be suddenly identified in a certain way without all these other factors taken into account. So again, it's like Big Brother is watching, and that just feels...
Ken, I'm glad you called in and raised these issues. Thank you very much for your call. Sharon, what about that? Because, I mean, obviously, that is a big part of this. I mean, now we have been focusing so much on the individual, but risk factors is something, when we're talking about mental health issues, that is a huge part of this, if not maybe the biggest part of this, in that... There are things that can happen in the background of a family. You mentioned that genetics, a big part of it, traumatic events, socioeconomic, race. He mentioned race. I saw that a statistic yesterday that said that people of mixed race are much higher percentage of having mental health problems than even Latinos or even Caucasians. A lot of different factors there. So address his point.
Well, I'm so glad he called in and asked these questions, because environment is key to a lot of problems. And there are some people that can just go through those negative environmental problems and come out okay. And then there's others that may have a mental health problem develop. And it's not just environment. It's also the entire chemistry of the body. So we are not saying that therapy is not important. Therapy is very important. It helps people learn how to handle issues that may have created problems for them and how to overcome them so they stay brain healthy. And so, and we also are not Big Brother looking over the shoulders.
But I guess
people.
The point he's making there is that if you take, say, the test, the My Brain 365, and there you see something that's a little bit different, maybe there's a bad day, a day or two, that people are going to go into therapy, maybe as young people, that maybe don't need it.
Right. And Mike can address that much better than I.
Okay, Mike.
Yeah, I thought he raised a couple of good points in Sharon's answer about the impact that the environment has on a person's mental status. And being somebody who's 68 years old, and I'll identify for your audience that I'm African-American. I was principal of that suburban high school that was not really representative of my background. And so the idea behind My Brain 365 is not to play the role of Big Brother, but it's to put a tool in the hands of anyone from the age of 6 to 106 so that they can begin to do some self-assessment, and in that self-assessment really have a sense of how well they are doing at any given moment, and also how well they might be doing in moments of high tension, high stress, high anxiety. And when you think about the trauma that a person can experience in his or her life as a result of many, many things, wouldn't it be great if they had a resource available to themselves where they could do a self-assessment and find out if there is a reason they need to look a little bit deeper, a little bit further, or even begin to share some things with a person close to them, whether it can be a sibling, a parent, a teacher, a counselor, a doctor.
But we want to make the point that this is not the be-all and end-all.
Absolutely not.
That people can, obviously, can follow traditional paths if they are noticing some symptoms. And let's talk about that. What about some of the symptoms that people have? When we're talking about illnesses, the word symptom comes up. What symptoms should people be looking for if maybe they should be seeking help, or maybe they should be questioning whether they're on the road to a serious mental illness?
Well, I'm glad you asked that. I have loved ones in my family that I've had to help, and a lot of people call us and talk to us about their signs and symptoms. We're not a service provider. We're just an educational arm for information. And so what I know is that calling them a disease, saying that they're sick, helps them understand that they have a medical condition that can be treated, and it should be treated early. And then, I mean, right there on our resource page with these cards I was telling you about, stage one of a person who would be a high school student or an adult, of not older adult, not middle school, but the age group of high school to adult. If you have senses that are heightened, like you're smelling and you're hearing or you're tasting, a lot of people present that they either don't want to eat anything or they are eating all the time and they're putting on weight. And feeling like you're in a fog and your concentration is clouded and you can't concentrate. You can't even read a book. You can't read a paragraph. Sense that something's just not right. Or you have body aches with no explanation for them. Okay, these are early signs and symptoms that going to the family doctor and having them medically check you out in all areas, including the mind, is very important. Mm.
Okay, but getting to the point where someone is maybe on the road to a mental illness like depression, what kind of symptoms are we looking at that point?
Well, that is on the road.
Okay, well, that's on the road, but that's probably stage one, as you mentioned.
It is. It's stage one. And so I've experienced it with several loved ones in my family because it runs in my family.
I think almost everyone has.
Yes. And so as they're progressing into this darkness, okay, you want to get them the help that they can get as soon as possible. And medication works and therapy works the best together, okay? And when people know that they can get well, because we are out there telling people they can get well, and we're hearing from people with serious mental illness that they were never told they could get well, and they can get well. Because the brain, we know, has plasticity to it now. And so we do regenerate neurons. And so that can happen when we were years ago told that that doesn't happen.
Let's take a phone call from Debbie in Camp Hill. Debbie, you're on the air.
Yeah, I guess, you know, I have a question. She was saying about us, you know, taking people to family doctors. And, you know, I feel like family doctors aren't prepared for this. You know, a lot of them over-medicate. Some of them put them on the wrong medication. Are they being taught then, like algorithms, what to do with certain things?
Thank you for your call.
I'm going to answer that. We wish we could have enough of providers that access to care would be prompt and appropriate right away. The sad thing is it's not. We have very few psychiatrists, especially children psychiatrists, psychologists too, and even family doctors. So what we are encouraging is for access to prompt appropriate care to start at the family doctor. My family doctor was awesome, okay? In fact, I'm an example of prevention. My daughter was married to a war hero in Iraq. And she started to slip, and she was in another state. And so I was able to, you know, I was in charge, and I'm far, far away from there, trying to help her go to the doctor and get help. So if you start with your family doctor, then you can go from there. So what my family doctor did was he said, you need to be strong, Sharon. You need to be strong because you're who she has. And guess what? He put me on an antidepressant. And if I hadn't been on that antidepressant when I was strong but going weak, I couldn't have helped her get well. And the good news is she's well and has a beautiful family.
When you say she was slipping, what was she doing?
Not focusing on, she was a civil engineer, not focusing on the computer. And luckily she worked with a family engineering company that had depression in their family, and they spotted it.
So she was depressed?
Yeah, very much so.
What's the difference between being depressed and just being sad?
You can get over the sadness, and usually there's a reason for the sadness. And lots of people that are depressed try to find good reasons why they're depressed. So, they say, the people are saying that if you feel like that for two weeks, go to the doctor. I'm sorry, if my daughter waited 2 weeks to go to the doctor, she'd be dead. She needed to know that she needed to get to the doctor right away.
So she was seriously depressed.
She was seriously, seriously depressed. Mm-hmm.
Michael, go ahead.
I also have an adult daughter who suffers from depression. And as Sharon has described, and probably a lot of your audience members who have had family members or friends suffer from depression, you know, they've seen their loved ones kind of go down that track. The thing that I wanted to quickly mention that I really like about our relationship with Sharon is that we're really working to encourage increased awareness. And with increased awareness, it really gives a person, and it actually gives, families and schools and society in general a better opportunity to begin to proactively try to address these kinds of issues, rather than being a reactive society or rather than being a reactive school or a reactive family. If we can really raise awareness and give people information, give people resources, give people tools to take care of themselves better. We talk about with our vice president of medicine for our company. He talks about a healthy brain lifestyle, and there are things that we all can do that will help with the health of our brains. And when you have a healthy brain and you can maintain a healthy brain, you have a better chance of being mentally well over the span of a life.
Even when you do have those environmental
yes.
factors as we're talking about. Hey, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you very much, for at the very least that we raise awareness about this issue and that we have people thinking about it and thinking about the language, thinking about their brain health, thinking about what they can do to get better and maybe prevent some a serious mental illness or substance abuse problem down the road. Thank you very much for being with us today. Sharon Engdahl's Executive Director of the American Mental Wellness Association, Michael Hauser, Vice President of School Youth Programs with RC21X and My Brain 365. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you
very much.
Thanks, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. 15 years ago, a 14-year-old student at Red Lion Area Junior High School in York County walked into the school and shot and killed Principal Eugene Segro before killing himself. Kelsey Lauder was a teenager and student at Red Lion Junior High School when the shooting occurred. Experiencing a school shooting gives her and her classmates a perspective that many others don't have when it comes to school safety or gun violence. Lauder and several others organized a March for Our Lives rally in downtown York tomorrow to protest gun violence. It's one of hundreds of March for Our Lives events across the country after last month's school shooting in Parkland, Florida, that left 17 people dead. Kelsey Lauder joins us on the phone now. Ms. Lauder, welcome to the program.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit. Let's go back 15 years to Red Lion Junior High School. So you were a teenager at that point. What happened that morning from your perspective?
Sure. Yeah, I was 13 years old in eighth grade. So what happens every morning is that if you get there too early, the eighth graders have to go to the cafeteria and the seventh graders go into the gym and you kind of wait there until the bell rings. And then everybody goes to homeroom. And so that morning, for me personally, I remember walking in. I can picture, I still see the hallway. I still see the clock on the wall. I still remember passing the cafeteria and thinking to myself, okay, do I walk in there or do I go talk to my teacher? Because I wanted to go talk to my teacher about something, and I saw Dr. Seeger come to start locking the doors as he does every morning when he says, okay, no more kids can come in, just go straight to homeroom. And so he was coming to lock the doors, and I saw my friends at the table, and I just thought, I'll see them later. And I just continued on for whatever reason was pulling me away that morning. And it was probably within the next 30 seconds that he, you know, turned around and was shot and killed. So I thankfully, unlike many of my classmates who were in there, I did not witness it. However, it's hard to explain the gravity of that situation when you're in it and you don't know what's happening, and all of the teachers start to panic. I reference a lot that I'll never forget how hard my homeroom teacher grabbed my arm, because I was in the hallway at the time that, you know, word started to spread really fast, and she grabbed me with such protective force and threw me into our homeroom classroom. And, you know, you have to think there were no cell phones at this time, so we had no way of communicating with each other. I didn't know if my friends were okay. We don't know what happened. I couldn't talk to my parents. And from then, it's just like a tailspin of welcome to the world of being a school shooting survivor and being escorted out of the building by police, having to wait hours until your name is called to go be reunited with your parents, and then all of the emotions that follow that, and just how difficult it is as a 13-year-old to process. I mean, it's something that's taken a long time to even be able to talk about.
Kelsey, can I get you to pick up the phone rather than the speakerphone?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah, if you could do that. We can understand you, but I just wanted to make, I think it's a little bit clearer.
I'm sorry, I wasn't even on speaker. I'm on my headset, so
okay.
This is better.
That's a little bit better. So did you actually hear the gunshots?
I did not.
You didn't?
I did not.
But during that 30 seconds, did you actually know what was going on?
I had no idea. Oh, no. We had no idea until after my homeroom teacher threw me into the room, and one of my classmates in my homeroom had told us what happened.
So, as I said, you were there, and it took a long time, I'm sure, and this is probably something you deal with every day. Is that the case? I mean, it's been 15 years. Do you think about that day every day?
Every single day. There's something in my everyday that brings it up, whether it's a song or the news or just a moment. I don't know. But every single day it does come up.
So, unfortunately, in the past 15 years, there have been a number of school shootings around the country. I mean, the latest in Parkland, or I shouldn't say the latest. No, the latest was in Maryland just this week. But on Valentine's Day in Parkland, Florida, where 17 people were killed. On days like that, when there are school shootings, what goes through your mind?
It's awful. I mean, for up until the Parkland shooting, which I'm sure we'll talk about why this one's different, you know, I can still vividly remember the day Sandy Hook happened just as much as I can Red Lion Junior High. It was so gut-wrenching to me, and you're just immediately taken back to that day. And not only do you relive that day for yourself, but you think, oh my God, all of these kids and all of these families are now in this club, for lack of a better term, that you don't ever want to see any more kids have to join. And that's kind of, it breaks my heart, and you go through all this sadness and grieving and anxiety that comes along with remembering a day like that, and just knowing that, I say this all the time, but as a 13-year-old, it was so hard to process. And they did their best to provide the resources afterwards, but I don't think anybody realized the effect that it had on you until you just continue to grow up and you know, how it shapes your life.
So, Kelsey, you and a number of your classmates and many other people are participating and have organized this rally in York. It's one of hundreds, maybe thousands around the country that will be going on tomorrow. What do you want the rally to achieve?
Yeah, I think what's really important to recognize is, you know, these school shootings, not even school shootings, because I don't even want to focus on that. It's not just schools to me. It's anytime. When I heard about Las Vegas, when I hear about the movie theaters, when I hear about the churches, like all of those incidences bring back memories, because why these, you know, public mass shootings are happening continue to just blow my mind. And every single time we get so worked up as a society, we, you know, fascinate over what should be done, what could be done. But then I think what happens is, one, we realize that it's too complex of an issue to deal with, so we would just rather forget about it. And two, it's easier to just tell yourself that it can't happen to you so that you can move on and, you know, try to live a life not being in fear. So what we want to try to, like, help people understand is this can very much happen to you or somebody you know, and if we don't do something about it soon, it's going to keep creeping closer and closer to home. And it's already happened here. Like, we are living proof that, you know, we've survived this, and I think some people tend to forget about that. And so we want to remind people that it's already hit this community, and that if we don't actually do something about it and we don't use our voices collectively and stand up against it, it's going to keep happening.
Kelsey Lauder is one of many people who will be participating in the March for Our Lives rally in downtown York tomorrow. What time is that rally, Kelsey?
Yeah, so tomorrow it's going to start at 10, and I want to, you know, preface that this is so much more than just, you know, we're not going to stand up there and be like, screw your guns, take away all the guns. That's not what this is at all. It's very much, we want to raise awareness to the issue. We have perspectives from both sides of the fence, and I think we're really just going to raise awareness on the issue and what can really truly be done. Because as I said earlier, it's super complex, and there's lots of different things, but there are certain things that we can act on immediately and that we can all get involved in to make sure that this doesn't happen again. So tomorrow, our march starts at 10 a.m. in downtown York. We have an event on Facebook that you can find. That's the best way to get information. But also, I know that there's, you know, people listening with throughout York and maybe further away, that there's a march in Harrisburg, there's a march in Lancaster. If you're closer to D.C. or want to go down to the big march, there's going to be close to 500,000 people down there marching. So as you said earlier, they're happening everywhere all over the country.
Kelsey, thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Kelsey Lauder. Want to move on to another tragedy in York County. Yesterday was one of the saddest and most tragic days in the history of the city of York. Two firefighters were killed when a building badly damaged by fire on Wednesday collapsed. 20-year veteran firefighter, 50-year-old Ivan Flashka, and 29-year-old Zachary Anthony, a firefighter since 2010, were identified as the victims. Joining us on the phone now is Philip Givens, who is the chief of staff for Mayor Michael Helfrich. Mr. Givens, welcome to the program.
Hi, Scott.
I only have about 2 minutes. I wish we had more time. As I said, a tragic day, one of the saddest days in the city of York. What happened yesterday?
Well, Scott, mainly my purpose of the call was to update your listeners to say that we will have more information in the coming days as far as how they can support the families affected by the tragedy. We've had obviously thousands of people reach out. You know, we suffered a great loss by losing two firefighters yesterday. And the thoughts of the people of York are with the families, friends, and firefighters. So it's a tough day for all of us down here.
But at the same time, and I only have about 60 seconds left,
sure.
As I said, there was a fire on Wednesday, building collapsed. The firefighters, what were they doing in that building yesterday?
So the firefighters were inside addressing hotspots and flare-ups that were still inside the structure. Had those hotspots not been addressed, the building potentially could have become engulfed again, which would have put neighboring homes and structures at risk. So they were still very much in the middle of an active fire, and they were fighting that.
So I understand, as I mentioned, Ivan Flaska and Zachary Anthony. In about 25 seconds, what can you tell me about them?
Well, Mr. Flaska was a 20-year veteran of the force, and Mr. Anthony was only 29 years old. He's been with us for about 8 years. So, you know, they're both very respected. And as Chief Michael said yesterday, if you called 911, those were the guys that you wanted to see on the fire truck.
Philip Given is the Chief of Staff for Mayor Michael Helfrich. Thank you very much for your call.
All right. Thanks, Scott.
I wish we had more time to discuss that, but as I said, a very tragic day and sad day in the city of York yesterday, and really the entire region. I think this is, you don't have to be close geographically to feel something for that these people that risk their lives every day. Have a good weekend.